I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
It's great to see you all here, and isn't it wonderful to have Carrie Brownstein with us? There will be a chance for you to ask questions, but first of all, we're going to talk and Carrie's going to read a little bit, and that will be for about 45 minutes. This is a wonderful book. It's also a beautifully written book. And Carrie skewers many things in it, one of which is a certain kind of England. And so I thought I'd start by quoting her on when Slater Kinney played All Tomorrow's Parties at the Camber Sands Pontins. She said, "The American equivalent of this facility would be like staying at a Super 8 motel, still decorated for Easter 3 months past the holiday, and featuring a rain-soaked, outdated McDonald's play area partially closed for construction." I think we can all recognise those places. So that gives you an idea not only of the brilliance of her writing, but the sharpness of her eye. She returned more recently in March with a triumphant tour with the reunited Slater Kinney, playing at the Roundhouse and elsewhere to great acclaim. I wanted to start, Carrie, by asking you, after this amazing career in music and then the extraordinary success of the Portlandia series on TV, you decided to write a book. And what was it like writing a book?
It's a terribly isolated experience compared to the collaborative endeavors of both Slater Kinney and Portlandia. I'm used to having other people augment and inspire my own ideas, challenge them, all the time, and just that way of like hoping that what we're going to do is greater than the sum of its parts. And with writing, especially something long form, I felt like I was my own worst enemy at every step. And you don't sort of have that kind of built-in cheerleader or sidekick that you do in a partnership. That was the most striking to me, is that there was sort of nothing magical about it, which I suppose you know as a writer. You just have to sit down and tackle the task at hand. And that, for me, required a lot of deliberation and intentionality and was very frustrating at times.
It's interesting you use the phrase your own worst enemy, because another remarkable aspect of this book is how relentlessly you pursue yourself and deliver yourself up as the child who was terribly anxious but made performing and demanding attention as a way of expressing anxiety, or the young woman who wanted to be in a band and went off somewhat unprepared for an audition, which with a band who didn't want you but later turned up. And yeah, perhaps you'll read a bit from the book about that and tell us a bit about it.
Sure, I can set that up. When in between, I transferred universities when I was 18 years old. And in that interim, I auditioned for a Seattle band called Seven Year Bitch. This was in probably 1992, and they needed a guitar player. And I barely played guitar. They put an ad actually in a local paper, which is very surprising if you can imagine a band that you've heard of, like the National or something, or I don't know. I'm trying to think of, I always try to think of the English equivalent. let's see, I don't know. Basically putting an ad. Yeah, the National, you know who that is. You know, putting an ad, they put an ad in the paper that said, girl guitarist wanted no wanky solos. And I thought, well, I can't even play a solo, let alone a wanky one. So I show up at this, I'm living in the suburbs, and I drive to the audition, and I'm wearing a really terrible outfit.
Which she describes in great detail in the book.
Yeah, anyhow, so I didn't get the part. But I continued in the very sort of audacious way that they often do, and with a lot of gumption and moxie, kind of pursuing this person as if she was going to eventually acquiesce and let me into the band. That never happens. So later, she comes to one of the Slater-Kinney shows, and I will read from that part. Her name, by the way, is Elizabeth. She was the bass player in Seven-Year Bitch. During the next few months, I occasionally ran into Elizabeth at Seattle shows and music festivals like 1077's Endfest. She was always kind to me, but I had clearly become a pest. Later, when I knew what it felt like to carry the weight of your fans' aspirations, I would remember the way Elizabeth looked at me after I'd sent the letter, a look of pity, distrust, and weariness. There's a gulf of misunderstanding between musicians and their fans, and often so much desperation that the musician can't possibly assuage, rectify, or heal. You feel helpless and you feel guilty. With Slater-Kinney fans, I tried to be generous, but I soon grew uneasy. For a long while, I could share nothing more than the music itself. I think I was too scared to be open with the fans because I knew how bottomless their need could be. How could I possibly help if I was just like them? I was afraid I might not be able to lessen their pain or live up to their ideals. I would be revealed as a fraud, unworthy, and insubstantial. The disconnect between who I was on and off stage would be so pronounced as to be jarring, me so small, so unqualified. In the early years of Slater-Kinney, we played at Seattle's Crocodile Cafe. Elizabeth was at the show. By then, Seven-Year Bitch had broken up. She came up to me, complimented my guitar playing, and told me she loved the band. Elizabeth didn't recognize me as the girl who had gone over to her house that day or written her an overly earnest tell-all letter. I was relieved that music had done exactly what I had always wanted it to do, which was turn me into someone else.
Mm. Yeah. Now, the hunger you talk about there, the hunger of the fans that cannot be assuaged, reminds me, of course, of your title and the fact that it's a line from your song, mm-hmm. Modern Girl. And it seems to me to be about the hunger we all feel in adolescence. We don't know what we're hungry for. Mm-hmm. We're just hungry. Is that why you chose it?
Yeah, I think there is a particularly inarticulate hunger, kind of an amorphous, almost insatiable hunger as a teen. And we try to sort of feed ourselves through so many different outlets. Sometimes it sates us and sometimes it leaves us feeling emptier. And I think that's a very pronounced loneliness, I think. I think the worst kind of loneliness is to sort of feel that you're around people, but that you're not being seen. And I think in a figurative way, it's that invisibility and that lack of embodiment that we feel as young people, but I think that permeates, us. It's very permeating into adulthood, and I think it's something striving for that embodiment and seeking it through creativity is so much of what the book is about. But there is something I think particularly striking about the means that one goes to be seen, sometimes at one's own detriment. And sometimes actually, the sort of paradox of self-effacement in order to be seen, sort of this act of denial in order to be present.
And part of the denial being the denial of the possibility of humiliation mm-hmm. as well. So it is a real obliteration of the ego. It's mm-hmm. not really, what you're saying, it strikes me that when you talk about your childhood and all the things you did to grab the floor to get attention, mm-hmm. Which you give us very honestly, performing, the need to perform seems to have come before music being the means of performing.
Oh, yeah. There were many, many times that I tried to perform, whether it was my Duran Duran cover band, which was called Lil Dieter.
Was that the one that involved the dog?
No, that didn't involve the dog. Lil Dieter and Duran was the name of the cover band, and it was L-I-L apostrophe. And cover band is again, a generous term, because we weren't playing anything. We weren't playing cover songs, and we just designed instruments out of wood. And I was Simon Le Bon, of course, because I think when you're the neighborhood impresario and you're the leader, you get to choose who you're going to be. And I insisted, even though everyone else was air guitaring or air keyboard, I actually sang over the music. And so, yeah, there was just like a continual and constant mode of performance for me. I think it was the way that I made sense of the chaos that I was starting to feel at home, and also the way I sort of felt most comfortable interacting with people was sort of this heightened way of being in a room or in a situation. I think it gave it a structure. There's something about performance. I mean, there's a formality to it. There's a beginning and a middle and an end, and I think when you're entrenched in that sort of unknowing messiness of youth or of sadness, you don't feel the edges. Mm-hmm. And performance had a beginning, and then it had a finale, and I was so grateful to know when something would end, especially if I could control it. So yeah, I really flung myself very, very vehemently into situations. Mm-hmm. It was also a lot of fun, but I felt like I kind of kept people, held people hostage a little bit with my desire to entertain them.
It's as if it gives you a sort of choreography of experience, rather. Mm-hmm. It turns the chaos into a kind of choreography, or you can find steps to take and a thing mm-hmm. to be.
Yeah.
And you can name it.
The moves marked out on the floor.
Yeah. 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 No, I completely understand that. And then you talk wonderfully about first going to see bands and how when you went to see the B-52s, how you were so pressed up against the barrier that you bruised your ribs. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think about how much you wanted not only to experience this thing, but you wanted it to have an impact, that mm-hmm. you wanted you to have an impact on it and it to have an impact on you. Mm-hmm. And was these early trips, because you went to see Madonna and you saw George Michael and you screamed and screamed.
Yes.
And was this was this a moment of recognition more than discovery, as in, this is my thing?
I think more so with George Michael than Madonna, actually. with Madonna, I mean, that was just pure adoration. I actually had a lot of pictures of Madonna on my wall, and I remember crying to my mother. Mm-hmm. Well, I asked her, like, will Madonna and I ever be friends? And when she said no, I was crestfallen. And she was right, because we're still not friends. with George Michael, I remember the Faith tour. Faith was his album in the 80s, and women loved George Michael. We didn't, and George Michael loved women at the time, we all thought. And so it was mutual. And I remember my friend, I was young, I was 13 or 14, and my friend turned to me and she said, I want to give George Michael a blowjob. And I was like, I don't. that was a moment of recognition, of feeling like, you know, I would rather be the object of desire. And I don't even necessarily mean physical, like, lust, but just I want to be the one upon whom people project imagination and longing. And, you know, I don't want to be sort of a passive recipient of this person's energy, even though that was also a way of fueling myself. But I felt like it was a much more symbiotic relationship. I didn't just feel like a vessel upon which, you know, someone else was just kind of throwing their creativity and art. Like, I pushed back. And I think as a listener, as an audience member, I pushed back and I kind of willed myself through the act of watching and observing. I willed myself into that very narrative. And I've always been an observer, and I think it's sort of the way that I navigate things.
Well, that pushing forwards and pushing back is very much like the experience of music that you describe, which is that it makes us feel more like ourselves and also that we are escaping ourselves mm-hmm. at the same time.
Yeah, it's very kind of a weird duality, I think, especially playing music. The cloak, I guess, of volume, particularly in Slater-Kinney, where there's so much you can obliterate with noise, and I think that we really took advantage of and relished kind of sitting within a sonic landscape that seemed to permeate and expand past the boundary of a given space. I felt like I could disappear in that. But at the same time, it was the first moments that I felt most embodied. There's this essayist in the U.S., Charles D'Ambrosio, and he talks about writing as a dream of making the distance go away. And music was very much that for me. You know, I felt like this divided self and... the dream world of Slater-Kinney, what I desired most from performance was to make that distance go away. And part of that distance was just the distance between my head and my body. And it was, I really embraced the physical nature of performing and the way that that gave me a sense of who I was for the first time. And also a sense of being outside myself. And that combination, I think, is very special and very awesome. I guess.
Yeah, and noise being, there's the noise that in the depths of music, the noise that's in the depths of words, and the noise that the band made, it means unlike any other, and it does have that centrifugal feeling of bits kept trapped with, you know, but not quite meeting and mm-hmm. expectations kind of being subverted, and which keeps that space closing, but the live, you know, there's mm-hmm. a sense of absolute liveness to this feeling that this is giving substance. It's not sort of things are in place now. Because when you talk about the pop you grew up with, you use a phrase, is it the synthed out pop of the 80s? Mm-hmm. And how when you discovered bands like Bikini Kill, that you were discovering music which you said can be performed, isn't just performed, it's played. Mm-hmm. And that's about discovering noise as well, isn't it? That mm-hmm. that there's something about the visceral nature of the making of it and the response to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I guess it has to do with the tactile and kind of yeah. understanding process a little bit, and it really took for me seeing those bands playing and having seeing fingers move upon a fretboard or seeing a little bit of spit leave a singer's mouth as they project, seeing glances between two players looking down on the ground and seeing effects pedals, the amp settings, like that, it's very immersive. And I do think, I think some people can sort of revel in the invisibility of sound, I mean, when someone's sort of playing something off a laptop or when you are just hearing something. But for me, I needed a relationship with the doing, yeah. and the production. And I think it's just about demystification and realizing that I could do that too was very important to me. But sound and the way that you're talking about how Slater-Kinney didn't, me and Korn's guitar in particular, even our voices, they didn't always match up. I think about the same thing with discourse and the ways how misunderstanding works and the ways that, there are pauses and miscommunication. Mm-hmm. And I love that. We use that a lot in Portlandia too. Repetition, duration, the way you stay on something when you don't know where else to go. And to me, when people ask about the differences between Slater-Kinney and Portlandia, I actually focus so much almost in a and linguistic way on the way that they're very similar.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you have something to read us about noise and...
Sure. Yes, I do.
Yes.
Were you like, chance. get to it.
Here is not at all. Something she prepared earlier.
Yes, yeah. I prepared earlier when I wrote this. this is from the era of Call the Doctor, which was in the mid-90s. On the title track, Corinne and I each sang a melody on the chorus. She was louder than me, so her vocal was the lead by default. But we never really considered one a background part to the other. It was a conversation we were having. She had her perspective and I had mine, or I was emphasizing her point, retelling it even as I was singing along with her. And our guitars did the same thing, augmenting and counteracting each other. We would get to the chorus, and intuitively you'd think, this is the time for us all to sing together, that there should be a cohesion, but instead we would split apart. It was almost an anti-chorus. We weren't trying to form a solidarity with anyone but ourselves. Could you sing along to Slater Kinney? Sometimes, but we'd just as likely shout over you. And good luck trying to sing along with Corinne. Trust me, I know. It's nearly impossible. As a listener, you have to decide what to follow in the song, which vocal, which guitar. This way of writing and singing was something we tacitly understood. We never discussed it. We never mentioned counter melodies. We didn't want to sing harmonies. Our songs weren't pretty, nor was our style of singing. It sounded scarier to not sing together, rarely allowing the listener to settle into the music. Everything inside the songs was constantly on the verge of breaking apart. Corinne's voice, the narrative, the guitars, so few moments provided any respite at all. If we did sing together on the chorus, it was only after a strange, uncomfortable verse. Yet the result was forceful. It sounded like a tightly bound entity, fragments clinging to each other for dear life. If you pulled one thing apart, it wouldn't even sound like a real song. It was a junkyard come to life.
It reminds me of this lovely phrase where you say that Slater Kinney songs would make really horrible background music.
Yes.
Which is a triumph, isn't it?
It is a
yeah.
triumph.
Yeah.
It will never be played in a
supermarket.
A store. Yes. No shopping store, no shopping malls. I have heard it before, and it's terribly unsettling. I've heard it once while getting my hair cut, and I actually didn't recognize it. I might have even said in a really like sort of grandmotherly way, like, what is this racket? Also dig me out, John Goodmanson, our producer, panned everything, the guitars. My guitar is way on the left and Corinne's is way on the right, and I was sitting in a particular part of the salon that I could only hear Corinne's guitar part. I was like, what is this?
Can we talk a little bit about the kind of movements that were around when you were forming, so Riot Girl and punk? And again, you're very clear about how these kind of incredible sort of surges of and coherences of ideology and determination and collectiveness can rigidify and become, you talk about Riot Girl, you say, a movement that professed inclusiveness seemed to actually be highly exclusive, as alienating and ungraspable as many of the clubs and institutions that drove us to the fringes in the first place. One set of rules had simply been replaced by new ones, and they were just as difficult to follow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are reasons that sort of early forms, early movements, incarnations of movements are strident. Yeah, they have to be. They have to establish themselves in opposition to so many things and protect the insularity that there just is. It's very calcified, and it's not a very malleable time, because you're just in a kind of a mode of defense. And Riot Girl certainly was on the defense, a highly misunderstood movement, especially by mainstream media, who sort of immediately tried to kind of commodify it or kind of reduce it to something sloganistic or very simplistic. And then, of course, it was a term applied to music, and it really didn't describe anything about the music. Mm-hmm. And the bands that were sort of being attributed to Riot Grrrl sounded actually quite different from one another. So there was a lot of oversimplification that I think people were rejecting, and rightly so. However, I think that, you know, that kind of rigidity is very alienating, and I think that it was sort of difficult at the time to be able to have questions about what was happening, because it just felt like, well, there's only one answer, and that answer, it was like sort of tautological. It's like, well, the answer is Riot Grrrl. It's like, well, what is that? Well, we don't know. You know, it's just sort of this snake eating its own tail, and again, kind of out of self-protection. But I think that's partly why Korn and I went as far away to Australia to form the band, is because we weren't certain that we could actually do what we wanted to do and have a sense of ourselves or be expressive within the confines of a place, I think, that was really struggling to really keep people out. And we didn't really want to keep a lot of people out. Like, we wanted to, first of all, have a sense of openness towards process, towards ambition, towards goals. And we also wanted people...
Thought.
Yeah, and we also wanted people to hear us, you know, and it felt like there was something a little bit about... felt like we were a little bit in a padded room in Olympia where you're only hearing your... what other people sort of want you to hear. And we wanted to let everything in. So we left, and then we came back after we'd made our record.
And another aspect of this is the old thing of being described as women musicians and a female band. And you say this thing about, so in Sleater-Kinney, we sang a lot about a world that we wished we could access without the added explanation or justification. Uh-huh. And that really struck me, that this is about saying, I am a musician, not I am a musician who happened, you know, does.
Yeah. That to me, I feel like, you know, when you put out a book or a film or a television show or anything, a piece of music, there it is at zero. And you want to start the conversation here and go forward. And I just felt like a lot of those questions about how it felt to be a woman doing that, how it felt to be a woman playing guitar, or a woman in TV, or a woman sitting in a chair. you know, it's just so much. It's like you spend all that energy. It's so arduous, and you're at a deficit, and you spend all your time getting to the place of neutrality, and then you're done talking about it, when really you just wanted to start at zero. And I think that that's very frustrating.
And the critical response, when you talk about having a narrative imposed on you, that if you are a person, let me just see, you said, if you haven't spent time deliberately and intentionally shaping your narrative, if you're unprepared like I was, then one will be written for you. And if you already feel like a fractured self, you start to feel like a broken one. So that wonderful innocence a band has, you know, it's like when you release a record or a book, if you've never done that before, you haven't yet been described. Mm-hmm. And then you are described, and then you have all these epithets attached to you, mm-hmm. and these preconceptions set up, and you suddenly find you're sort of playing in front of a mirror in which there is an image of yourself that isn't one you've created, mm-hmm. that's been created for you. It doesn't sound as if you had much joy in the experience of, I mean, not in the playing, but of that response.
Yeah, I mean, as you just eloquently described, I think that mirror is a little bit of a funhouse mirror, and you don't really, there's this sort of disassociation where you don't necessarily recognize the image being projected back onto you, but at the same time, you can't help but be curious about whether somebody is seeing a truth in you that you weren't able to recognize, and then you're sort of grappling with this idea of external identity, and in some ways it becomes like this sort of terrible existential or ontological crisis, and you just, you're sort of, you don't know where to set out from, because I think when you start writing and you have no external expectations on you, and it's just you and you in a room, whether it's your band or your writing partners or whatever, everything feels possible. And then once you're sort of a version of yourself is reflected back at you, that's kind of this composite of other people's perceptions. There is sort of a claustrophobia to that, mm-hmm. I think, and also, and it feels like limitations. And I think that can be very, very frightening. And especially, you know, I see it happen. You can kind of see it writ large with social media, that people kind of have to retract things all the time because they haven't had the a sense of, you know, like preparedness, I guess, for mm-hmm. what was going to be thrown at them. It can be very disorienting, and I think you have to start tuning that out because it creates a real self-consciousness, I think. So for me, I really had to retreat back to a place of, I guess, insularity. And I think as a band, we tended to tune that out a little bit because it was, we kind of felt like, you know, the monikers or what was sort of being thrown at us was not exactly apt, and but it also is empowering in that it's something to push against. You know, you always want something to push against, and if you feel that it's not a clear description or an apt description, then it's just fuel for the fire, I think.
And you were working so hard. I mean, 6 albums in 8-9 years, something like that. 10
years.
Gosh,
I don't know. Yeah, probably.
But the recording, the touring, the writing cycle was pretty relentless.
Yes.
And as you describe, eventually you got to a point where your body was objecting, mm-hmm. and you describe touring as a frightening and jarring existence. And I thought about what you said about how playing music gave you a form, and it also gave you a family. And I wondered if part of your eventual response to that was precisely because you'd got yourself a family and a form, and that there was something in you resisting that being fixed in that and had to kind of push against that.
That's very psychoanalytic.
Sorry.
And very interesting. Let me think about it.
No, just tell me I'm nonsense. Just say nonsense.
That's nonsense. That's absolute nonsense.
You can talk.
Blimey. I think that, I think that in some ways you're right, that I am fitful by nature. And I think that once something has a stability to it, I have a natural inclination to undermine, but also there was something very fraught about Slater Kinney. I mean, for each of us, I think we each tried to have the band be a substitute for family in a certain way, because even though we each had our own versions of family outside the band, there is a certain faith you put upon the endeavor to kind of hold you, because it's the thing that is carrying you away from those you love. And when it becomes desperate or despairing, it can feel, you know, it's very unsettling. And so I think that all of us were aware of the ways that it was tenuous. And yeah, so I think we all, I can't just say that I'm the only one that sort of, you know, was struggling against it, because I think what the band symbolized for all of us was something that it almost had too much weight on it. I think that's when we came back the second time, I think it was kind of in a better place of what it represented, you know, especially for Corin and I mean, it was like so monolithic for both of us, you know, it was something that we had sort of built up together. And, you know, I think it was very difficult because it kept having to be redefined, and sort of redefined to the point where it felt a little bit flimsy after a while.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And the structure of the book, you begin with the ending, well, the beginning of the hiatus, so the ending in 2005. But it ends with a beginning,
uh-huh.
and it ends with the beginning of the new phase
uh-huh.
and the wonderful new album
uh-huh.
and everything. Can you tell us a little bit about the coming back together and going back out on the road and making the new album? How, was it different?
It was different in a lot of ways. I mean, I think for one, it felt as a slight inevitability to the band getting back together. Sometimes the band feels like a force that is sort of like orbiting around us, and we just sort of leapt upon it, that we couldn't help it. And then, you know, I think that we all just have so many other facets to our lives now that there was just nothing about it that we took for granted, to be honest. And it was also the most deliberate songwriting, you know, in terms of editing. We were so aware of what we had done before. We were so scared of putting out something that wouldn't kind of live up to our own expectations or ideas of what the band could be. The Woods had been an album that we all were very fond of, and then critically had also done well, which again, you sort of keep on the periphery, but you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just, it was a hard album to write. We spent probably more time writing that album than we ever had. And then we loved touring with it, though. Some of our favorite songs to play live.
And, you know, it's considered one of your finest works, isn't it? In sort of general.
Yes,
it is. It is. It is.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And just seeing the film of the performance, say, at the Roundhouse, I mean...
It was very fun, yeah.
You're still all totally, you know, as you say, pushing back.
Yeah. Yeah, although I felt, yes, I think we are. And I think that the container of Sleater-Kinney is very unsuited for anything like too soft or demure. I think you kind of have to approach it with a certain energy. Otherwise, you're no match for the band. So I think that was part of it. But I think so much of what was painful about Sleater-Kinney the first time around, or not painful because actually there was so much joy, but hard for me, and I think was that so much of it was just, it was like we just had a fist out and it was about pushing away. And I think what we realized with No Cities to Love and in this second iteration in terms of touring was that it's just as powerful and galvanic if this is out, but it's an open hand, you know, and it's still something to fall into. It's still something to give into, but there is just an openness and there is just as much power in vulnerability, you know, as there is in rejection, you know, and so that's what we went for.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will now take your questions.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm from Spain, so my English may not be as good as yours, definitely not, but...
Totally fine.
I'll do my best. So, when I had to choose what I wanted to study in university, I don't even think communication exists as a degree. I'm not sure. But it never came to my mind, and I'm always on the scientific kind of things, and that's... I work in scientific fields and uh-huh. stuff, so nothing to do with that. So I was wondering... what did you know about, well, first of all, what was the name of your degree, like the specific?
Oh, sociolinguistics.
Sociolinguistics, okay. So, well, to the point. So what did you know about that degree before choosing it? Or how did you know that you wanted to spend years studying that?
Right.
That's my question.
Yeah. Well, when I went to college, I actually first, well, before I transferred schools, I was studying theater and drama. And when I transferred schools, it was actually just, I think this is often the case when you meet somebody who inspires you. And there was a professor at Evergreen State College named Susan Fixall, who was a sociolinguist, and her specialty was discourse analysis, and I was very interested in the ways people communicate and language acquisition and computer-mediated discourse, which had kind of just started to become in vogue, and now, of course, is like a very like popular topic in terms of sociolinguistics. And you often, there's little columns and papers about the way we communicate online and whatnot. But it really just took somebody else being passionate about something and seeing just things kind of align. Like, I was always an observer. I was always somebody interested in the ways people communicated verbally and non-verbally. I was very interested in orality versus literacy. There were so many facets of it that I was drawn to. I think it often does take a teacher. People often cite a specific person as kind of ushering them into a world, whether it's academia or not, because, you know, passion is infectious, and I think it allows you to see into a field that might seem esoteric in a way that seems really, really relatable and applicable. I mean, I think that's the other thing, you know, like to see it as something you can apply to your life, which I feel like I have done, even though I haven't continued on in academia. I feel like it's informed a lot of what I do.
So this is kind of random, but I'm studying abroad right now, and I'm doing a lot of traveling. So I was just kind of wondering, what has been your favorite place that you've traveled to?
Okay.
Pontins.
Pontins, for sure, yeah. Let's see. Well, I've been all over the United States, which is a very vast country. I love New Zealand, actually, quite a bit. It breaks my heart to say this, but I really love Paris. It's a wonderful city, and it's always magical there. I love Tokyo. I don't know. I feel very fortunate to have traveled many, many places, and but often what interests me are like the towns you pass through. To be honest, like one of the most fortunate, I guess, things about getting to drive places, which is also like terrible on your back and really hard on your body, is that you stop in the other places. You stop in the places that aren't known for their tourism or their, you know, their scenery. And you have interactions at a strange little restaurant or diner, or you, I don't know, that regionalism is something I'm really curious about. So yeah, I just, you know, drive like 60 miles outside of a city and see who lives there. I think that's those are some of the most interesting places.
I saw on Instagram that you were reading Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, mm-hmm. Which I just finished reading. Well, actually, I put her book down to start yours and then went back to it.
All right.
But I found some parallels. I didn't know that your mother suffered from anorexia, and I didn't know that Maggie Nelson's mother suffered from some form of disordered eating. And in the book, which is obviously a lot about motherhood and writing, she quotes Barthes as saying that a writer must play with his mother's body. And I was wondering if it was hard, you know, what your experience was in writing about your experience of your mother's anorexia in the book.
Mm-hmm. I guess from an actual just writerly perspective, it was not any more difficult than the other parts of the book. You would be sort of surprised. I think what kind of plagues you as a writer is not necessarily subject matter, but how to tell it. And sometimes things like touring or writing about an album was just as confounding to me as writing about something that I think the reader perceives as more sensitive. It was, I mean, I knew that I was going to write about that, and I wanted to, since it's so much a story about embodiment versus disembodiment, I thought it was important to include that because it had so much to do about with how sort of my early ideas of one's relationship to their own self, their own personhood was formed and kind of distorted in some ways. Although I think in that distortion and abstraction and the observation of that pain that I witnessed a lot of people thinking was, I think, a compassion. So it was, I guess that's the easiest way I can answer it, is that it wasn't any more difficult than any other part of the book, but I really knew that I wanted to include it thematically.
You spoke earlier about the Riot Girl scene and how, like, the rigidity of it. And with coming back, like, 10 years after the Woods with No Cities to Love, do you think the Riot Girl scene's, like, changed in any way over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of the second or third kind of iteration of it, or the way that people are kind of claiming that that term now, or that identity now, I think has a sophistication that early movements just are sort of unable to grasp. I think there's an intersectionality to it that speaks to sort of broader issues than just like, you know, white feminism or punk rock feminism. I think there's just, yeah, there's a multiplicity to it, I think, and an energy and an openness to it, and a levity to it that I think is very awesome, and I think makes it even more relatable and more generous, I think, than it was able to be early on. So yeah, it's kind of exciting to see the ways that it's permeated pop and underground culture now. There's some really great versions of it out there.
I just wondered whether there's any reason behind the book, what pushed you to write the book? Because you said it's a very difficult experience to go through. And absolutely agree. And is there any reason why? And is there any message that you would like to convey for the book in particular?
I mean, I think it's hard to set out with like sort of a like didactic message. Like, this is what I want people. Yeah, the book asks more questions than it does present definitive answers. I wanted to write about the process of creativity as a means of finding a sense of self and belonging, and I wanted to write about that those early experiences in music and performing, yeah, as just a way into learning about the world and finding community. I also just, I do like writing, and it's the kind of the common thread. I mean, as difficult as writing, like as a long form book is, writing something I've always done, and this felt like a good place to start, even though I've been, I guess, writing for Portlandia and Slater Kinney and doing other kind of screenwriting for a while. I wanted to start with this. I was really inspired by Steve Martin's Born Standing Up, which is just a similar kind of story of his kind of early years, you know, growing up, working at Disneyland, clowning, doing stand-up, sort of everything behind the scenes until he sort of comes on the stage in Saturday Night Live. And I liked that as sort of this, like, guide to growing up and what, you know, the ways that that art and creativity can change you and magnify you and help you. And so, yeah, that's why I wanted to write it. And I thought, this is a subject I know pretty well, and then it will help me write other things in the future, which I want to do.
Do you want to answer my question?
Yeah. First of all, just thanks for putting me on the guest list for tonight. That was really nice of you. You really didn't have to do that.
Oh, you're very welcome. That's you, Oliver.
Sorry?
Wait, what's your name?
Oliver.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I just said. Oliver.
Best friends.
I only recognize Oliver through social media. Because
I had to try and look as much like my profile
like
picture.
Avatar. I try to look like my avatar too.
Yeah, just so like you recognize me.
Yeah. Right, well. Nice to meet you.
If in some alternate universe, Slater Kinney had to go through like a radical genre change, which one would you choose to change to? Like, you had to completely change your sound. Like which one would you identify most with?
Okay, I like these kinds of questions. Gosh. I mean, it would be awesome to think that we could just, like, be a really good, heavy metal maybe seems too close to what we do, but, you know, and I just can't, I mean, hip-hop seems really like a stretch. just based on my own rapping skills, I don't want to throw corn under the bus. I'm sure she's amazing. Yeah, let me get saying disco. I think disco would be good. Maybe like country and western. Yeah. I think like a really good country album. I think corn can kind of pull that off. And then
psychobilly.
Yeah, psychobilly. But this is like micro genre over here. Yeah, we would be a psychobilly band. Yeah. So watch out for our next record.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just saying wanted to do more writing. I just wanted to ask, what like hopes do you have creatively? Like, what work would you like to do over the next coming 10 years? Any dream projects?
What's your 10-year plan?
My 10-year plan is just sleeping through it, resting. You know, it's really hard when people ask questions like that because I think that we always feel like we've got to just give these answers. Like, well, I'm going to build a house and I'm going to learn how to do farming and permaculture and then I'm going to run for office. And, but, you know, I feel really good where I am right now. I'm working on a handful of things that are mean a lot to me. Slater-Kinney, Portlandia, Transparent, this book. I'd like to continue writing. I'd like to make more television shows. Not even necessarily for myself to be in, but I love producing. I love writing. And that's really important to me. But a lot of my goals, I think, when I think like 10 years, have to do with happiness and other people's happiness and well-being. So that all kind of combines together. But yeah, I feel pretty good. But thanks. I'll keep working. When I get back to the hotel tonight, I will start writing something immediately.
I think, because you mentioned your sociolinguistics, and I think with Portlandia, it's kind of, I think that's riddled within it. And I really enjoy it, but I just wanted to know whether you consider yourself a comedian or funny. In a more kind of, obviously Fred Armisen is an SNL kind of
yes, he is
genius, but
he is a funny one.
Do you consider yourself a?
No, you know what? That's a good question. Actually, in some ways, I don't feel like my currency in life is humor. I think I am a keen observer. I think I have wit. But I think there are people, although you would be surprised, many of the funniest people that we all watch on TV and movies are not actually very funny in person. And that's true. And then some people kind of use that as like I said, the currency with that they use in their daily interactions. I don't think that that is my own currency, but I think that there, you know, that I can be sometimes a little bit funny, you know, but not always. And yeah, so, and Fred actually is not always doing bits either, by the way, but he is very funny. And I think he would put that as like the first thing he called himself. No, actually he'd say drummer. He wants to be known as a drummer. Just FYI, do not call him a comedian. So I hope that answered your question.
I think there's time for one more question.
Okay, make it good. This is how we're going out.
No pressure.
This is my last meeting in the UK. Up to you.
Wow.
I'm just kidding.
Good. Ask her what her favorite color is, so please.
Yeah, my favorite color. It can be anything. You can ask any question.
You've got it. That was it. No, I was going to say, in Portlandia, you have so many different personas. Uh-huh. You wear different wigs and you dress up as different characters, and it's great. How do you watch people in the street and think they'd make a good sketch, or like how do you come up with these characters? Is it you and Fred together, or how is that process kind of?
A lot of it, and I think one of the reasons that the show is kind-hearted as opposed to mean-spirited is because so many of the characters are permutations of who we are. It's just that. Like if, like Nance, of Peter and Nance, you know, such a cloying, syrupy couple. It's as if I just, you know, walked through a room without any bones in my body. That would be Nance. And, you know, I'm very obsessed with the ways people perform personhood and perform couplehood, especially couplehood. Like, I love when people, like, sort of display their, like, relationships in this way. And, like, Peter and Nance, you know, when you see couples just melting into each other, or like when I've done that with someone I'm dating, I'm like, oh my God, what if I did this all the time? And I had like no boundary between me and this other person. Like just, you know, we think about those things a lot. And so often it's us or our parents. So many of the couples are my parents' friends from Seattle. There's so many Seattle couples, and I know they're universal because people relate to them, but my friends from Seattle are like, they know these people. Kath is like
my most angry self. Like, Kath to me is like Slater Kinney. Like, if I didn't have a band, I would be Kath. I would be Kath 24/7. Which means I would have zero friends. And so most of the time it's just I'll observe something in someone else, or I'll feel myself doing something. Like, I remember there's this, do you guys have this yogurt called wallaby yogurt? Okay, it's like it has a kangaroo on it, as you can imagine, or a wallaby, sorry. And I was at a grocery store, and I had actually just gotten back from Australia, and for some reason, I was buying wallaby yogurt, and I told the cashier, for no reason whatsoever, yeah, I just got back from Australia. And then I just thought, what kind of person does that? Like, what is that part of me that wanted to overshare? And people overshare all the time. You know, I go to the bank and I let the bank teller know that I was just at the dentist. Why? But I'm so curious about why people do things. And I try to think, like, how can I make that little small thing a whole person? Like, what if I start from there? And so it's not, you know, sort of pointing someone out and being like, ha ha, that's funny, look at that weird person. It's more like, look at all these weird parts of myself. That's usually where it starts.
Please join me in thanking Carrie Brownstein very much for what's been a really wonderful evening.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
And thanks to Lavinia Greenwald and to everybody here.
Thank you all so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.